Welcome to the In Context War Report, produced by MDR Productions, Inc. The In Context War Report is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. Our website is incontextreport.com. I'm Gus Cantavero, the producer of the War Report, and here's your host, Ken McDermott Rowe.
Hello, everyone. This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and Gus and I are joined, as usual, by the War Report's military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott Rowe. In the War Report, we report on recent developments in war and geopolitics around the world. By placing these developments in historical context, we show how they affect global stability and U.S. national security. I'd like to start with a very important development close to home, the Obama administration's decision to restore diplomatic relations with Cuba. The announcement was made at the same time that Cuba released Alan Gross, an American held in a Cuban prison for 5 years. But first, a little background. The current communist government of Cuba came to power in a revolution in 1959. When the new government under Fidel Castro allied itself with the Soviet Union, the United States broke off diplomatic relations with Cuba and in 1961 mounted an invasion of the country at the Bay of Pigs. Although the invasion was unsuccessful, the United States since then has attempted to undermine Cuba through an economic embargo. Marshawn and Gus, what are the geopolitical and military ramifications of President Obama's new policy toward Cuba?
Well, I think a lot of this has to do with realpolitik. I mean, a lot of the pundits on the mainstream media outlets are saying, oh, this is atrocious. This is, shows the Obama's getting soft on communism. Reality, I think what he's doing is he realizes that Cuba is a traditional Russian ally and a Russian intelligence base really close to the United States. And I mean that in a very literal sense, in that Russia actually has an intelligence base that it was closing down under the years of the Bush administration. And since President Obama's anti-Russian rhetoric has stepped up and his anti-Russian actions have stepped up, the Russians have reopened it and started sending more troops there. So I think what this really is about is not, I mean, part of it is, you know, he wants to appeal to the Cuban population in America, but I think a lot more of it has to do with trying to pull Cuba out of Russia's sphere of influence.
The embargo does not produce any desirable results. It hasn't worked to undermine the Castro regime in any way. All it does is galvanize the country to pull itself inwards and put up a shield because they can always claim that they're under attack from an outsider, right? And has life in China gotten better or worse since free trade was opened up with that country? The communist regime in China really has been destabilized quite a bit in the past 20 years because the rising middle class there is demanding more fair treatment. You're seeing protests and farmer revolts out in the countryside. And so it's actually been a very good thing for China. You know, it hasn't necessarily been a great thing for American jobs, but if the stated goal is to undermine communism and increase living standards for poor people around the world, the desired result is slowly reaching a head of steam.
I see your point, Gus.
Absolutely.
And as more American contact comes to Cuba, and already Raul Castro, the current leader of Cuba, is allowing some small private business to exist.
Right.
He's allowing the ownership.
How is that a bad thing?
Ownership of property. I would think that the more American contact is going to encourage this. So it's really not realistic for us to insist that they have American-style elections in order as a prerequisite.
Right, because that goes so well in the Middle East.
Right, and it didn't, certainly was not a requirement when we had relations with China,
exactly,
under Nixon or with Vietnam.
After the death of Mao, and especially when Deng Xiaoping came to power, and you know, China had already been opened up to the West, he started to realize that there was a growing anti-communist sentiment. I mean, not necessarily in the fact that people were going to take up arms, but people were really starting to look at the West and get envious because now they had a window on the world and they wanted a piece of that. So the only way the communist regime could survive was by adopting elements of the West. You really want to undermine communism? You need to show them how people live here. Whereas what sanctions and embargoes typically do is they galvanize the populace because, yeah, their standard of living drops, but they don't blame their leaders. They blame you. It's much easier for a government to say, well, it's a fault of America when you have them embargoed than when you have trade with them. And the government tries to say, well, it's a fault of America. And they say, yeah, but the Americans are living very well and we're getting their products. We can see they're living better than we are. And we have nobody to blame but the communist regime.
A perfect example of that is the Cold War in Russia extended the life of the communist government there much longer than it would have if there was no Cold War, because even though America was trying to put pressure on communism to spend themselves into oblivion and the space race and the arms race and all this kind of stuff, they were constantly in a war spending economy. And the government always has increased power under a threat of war, which is exactly what the American government is doing now with the war on terrorism.
Well, now, the Russians were a very strong presence in Cuba. Of course, they had the missiles there, which precipitated Cuban missile crisis during the administration of President Kennedy. And more recently, as we reported, Cubans agreed to let the Russians reestablish a huge intelligence facility in Cuba. Mm-hmm. Where does this leave that intelligence facility and, in general, Russia's relationship with Cuba?
Well, opening diplomatic relations doesn't necessarily mean tomorrow they're going to run up and embrace us. I mean, again, they have a lot of bad memories of the Batista regime, which came before Castro, which was an authoritarian, despotic regime, which the United States supported at the time because Batista was anti-communist. So that does leave sort of a collective scar. However, there is a chance to try to pull Cuba into our sphere. And indeed, if we can bring the Cubans prosperity, great prosperity, then, I mean, it would give them every incentive to pull away from Russia. As it stands, though, right now, I don't see that happening.
Will it affect Russia's relationship with Venezuela?
Not at the moment, because even though we have relations with Venezuela, we attempted multiple times to topple Hugo Chavez, who had a very strong cult of personality in the country. And again, they look towards a lot of our Latin American friends, and they see that they're, you know, more or less banana republics. I mean, look at Mexico, our closest Latin American friend, and the country is a basket case. There is a great hesitance with, well, can we really trust these Americans? And I think with Cuba, it's really our opportunity to demonstrate, well, look, you know, we are a force to bring prosperity, not a force to bring despotism or instability.
And I mention that also because Russia has a naval base in Venezuela, and Cuba has very close ties with Venezuela.
I don't know if necessarily, again, they're going to pull away and evict the Russian Navy tomorrow. I mean, another element that's going to play a strong factor is the fact that also the United States right now is viewed as very weak. So the reason why, for example, the Assad regime never decided to embrace the United States was by and large because not only were we trying to topple his government, but more to the point, we clearly aren't very capable of protecting our ne'er-do-well allies, such as the Iraqis. So while there's an element of, okay, we can benefit from relations with the Americans, well, if we turn on the Russians, can the Americans protect us from the Russians? And that's going to be a very strong driving force in the mentality of the leaders and their choices whether or not to try to evict the Russians.
I think they'll go with whoever gives them the best deal. You know, the American deal is going to come with strings attached, as everything always does. And it's going to say, okay, we'll allow some, you know, Nike factories, some sweatshops to be built in your country in exchange for you kicking out the Russians and, you know, putting up the vacancy sign in their intelligence depot. And in exchange, they'll get some factory jobs, which will be good for the impoverished people in the countryside.
And although President Obama has probably been looking to do this opening with Cuba since he came into office, it does figure into what seems to be a concerted campaign to weaken Russia, to punish it for annexing Crimea and for resisting the NATO takeover of the Ukraine.
Right.
So let's talk about Russia under siege. economically, politically, and militarily, Russia is being pressed. We see the oil price drop is a killing Russian income, and the Russian ruble is collapsing. And I don't know exactly what's behind this oil price drop, but what certainly is hurting Russia, and it is possible that it's being somewhat influenced by our government, I would think.
I saw a very interesting stat yesterday about the Russian ruble in relation to the oil price drop, and that it is not as bad as it is being made out to be by the Western press, because the ruble dropping at the same time actually at a faster rate than the oil price drop is actually increasing the profit margin for Russian oil producers.
But make no mistake about it, they are in tough shape. And also,
it's not to say that it's a good thing, but it's also not crippling for them at the same time.
Well, they're also handicapped by the fact that that Russia is now subject to an embargo on finance.
Mm-hmm.
So as their large corporations need reloans to be rolled over in the coming year, they're going to be really pressed. They're probably going to have to get loans from the central bank in Russia. And so that's going to put a further crimp on their economy. And of course, they're also having to deal with a renewal of terrorism in Chechnya.
Mm-hmm.
March, could you talk about any of those factors and what kind of pressure Russians are under now?
I watched Vladimir Putin's speech to the Duma, was to the representatives of the Russian people. And one of the things that struck me the most was that the Russians have been combating Chechen terrorism since the 90s. And it led to a lot of anti-Muslim sentiment in Russia. Well, one of the things he did, which was from a political standpoint brilliant, was he sat, you know, on the right, from where the podium is, the right-hand side of the audience, all of Russia's religious leaders, including the Grand Mufti of Russia, who's the chief Islamic leader in Russia, right next to the chief rabbi and several Orthodox priests. And then he made light of the situation in Chechnya, but he blamed it explicitly in his speech on the CIA. Now, what this says is that because the Russian people, they follow Putin much more so than I think any, I mean, he has a cult of personality unlike any other Russian leader, probably since the time of Lenin. I mean, just like the people really believe in him. So when he blamed on the CIA, on the one hand, he was saying, look, it's not Russian Muslims. They're not waging the war. It's the CIA. It's the Americans. So when attacks like this occur, whether inspired, encouraged, or assisted by the Americans, or rather, if the Americans aren't even at all involved, the fact is that the Russians perceive it as actions of the CIA, the actions of the Americans. Instead of building a division in Russia, it's unifying Russians and building this very anti-American, not anti-Chechen, but anti-American sentiment in Russia, especially the fact that, like I said, he explicitly mentioned that the CIA was involved.
That goes back to what I was saying about the Cold War. It just gives the state more power.
Exactly. And to add to that point, too, the recent bill that was passed in Congress and then signed by President Obama December 16th. Mm-hmm. The resolution signed December 16th, which was entitled, I believe, Support for Ukrainian Freedom Resolutions. One of the clauses is allocating $20 million every year in support of Russian democracy and civil society organizations.
Color revolution organizations.
Exactly. In any other language. I mean, if we had heard the FSB, the successor of the KGB, was sponsoring democracy and civil society organizations in America, it would be pretty clear to us that they were sponsoring anti-government movements. It's becoming very clear that not only is the United States pushing for regime change and destabilization of the Russian economy, but it's also pushing with the forces of NATO to hem Russia in, the deployment of the 1st Cavalry to the Baltic states, the deployment of permanent tanks to Poland. In fact, the deployment of advisors to Western Ukraine really resonates with Russians as being a move to ultimately strangle Russia. The desired effect is that the Russian people get so disgusted they'll rise up against Putin. This doesn't work. I mean, if we look at Russian history, this doesn't happen. When the Russians feel hemmed in, they strike out. When they feel like they're getting strangled, they strike out.
You got to know your audience.
And we can see that with the Napoleonic Wars. Russia declared war on Napoleon because they saw him overrunning Prussia and Austria, and they thought, oh, geez, this guy's coming for us now.
Does this remind you of the resolution that was passed before the Iraq War with very similar language that eventually led to a full-scale invasion?
Well, in very many ways, yes. President Obama and I think the leadership in the United States are hoping to strangle Russia, that they'll collapse internally and then we won't have to have a war. But the fact is that what it's going to cause is Russia to lash out. And I mean, we saw the same thing with Germany because of the Treaty of Versailles. It didn't make Germany, at the end of World War I, permanently weak. It resulted in the rise of Hitler.
It's just human nature. I mean, if you keep pushing and pushing, it's more likely the other side is going to push back rather than they're going to give in.
And it's the same thing that happened with the Japanese. What prompted the Japanese to bomb Pearl Harbor was not because they hated the Americans and our freedom. It was because we put an oil embargo on Japan and they were waging a war in China and they couldn't wage that war without oil. So they attacked Pearl Harbor and decided to seize the natural resources of the Philippines and Southeast Asia. I'm not defending their actions in China, but I'm saying it's explainable. From a Japanese standpoint, it was rational. The same as the Germans backing an ultra-nationalist like Hitler. It was a very natural reaction to the humiliation and the economic hardships of the Treaty of Versailles. Instead of causing Germany to collapse inward, it resulted in the rise of somebody who was far more militant than the Kaiser ever could have been.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host. I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator, and Gus Cantavero, our producer. And we've been talking about the U.S. versus Russia rivalry in the world today and how Russia really is under siege. And we've also discussed the reopening of diplomatic relations between the United States and Cuba and how this figures into the rivalry between the United States and Russia. Marchand, what's the military situation in the Ukraine right now? Are the U.S. advisors going to make a difference? Is U.S. military hardware going to make the difference? Will the Russians just up the ante by contributing more forces and weapons to the secessionists in the eastern Ukraine?
Well, it's very possible that, I mean, right now it seems to be making a difference, but one thing we're not factoring in is winter. Right now, it's the dead of winter in Ukraine. It is bitterly cold and very difficult to fight in. Typically around this time of year, fighting subsides until the thaw starts to come, starts to get a little bit warmer. But what we are seeing is the Russians have been conducting snap military drills on the border with Ukraine, the eastern border with Ukraine. They also conducted on December 16th a snap drill in Kaliningrad, which is a Russian enclave in the Baltics. From what Ukrainian intelligence has said, the Ukraine Defense Ministry, is that more and more Russian arms are flooding into the rebels in the east. So temporarily, the U.S. advisors might be making a bit of a difference. But when the thaw comes, I mean, that's really when we're going to see the Russians come out more force. And indeed, again, these sanctions only produce a much greater, much more aggravated response. It's entirely possible that eventually the Russian leadership will just decide, well, either we stand still and we die because of these sanctions, because of the U.S. trying to undermine the Russian political system, which is by no means democratic, but I'm just saying. And they'll decide, you know what, it's time for us to militarily march on Kiev. We tend to treat Putin like Saddam, you know, some, you know, deranged megalomaniac. But the fact is, he's a very clever, very intelligent leader. For all our boasting, we really lack the military capacity at this stage to take on the Russians directly. And the Russians know that. It's just a question of, you know, if they will use it as their last resort, but we have to consider the fact that it is a possibility that the Russian army will become much more directly involved.
Have our leaders thought through the possibility of fighting a ground war in Eastern Europe?
I don't think seriously. I think they've deployed these tanks. They've deployed soldiers from the 173rd Airborne out of Vicenza, Italy, to the Baltics. I think most of it's done really as a show of force. We're banking on the fact that Russia really doesn't want to kill Americans, that they really don't want a war with us. And realistically, at this point, you got two trains on a collision course with each other. You know, an immovable force is about to meet an immovable object. That's really what we're seeing. Because in a man-for-man battle, the Russians in 24 hours can mobilize almost 400,000 men, tanks, planes, and ships. 500 men from the 173rd Airborne, as brave and as well-trained as they are, they're still not going to be able to take on 300, 400 Russian T-90.
And what would the Germans do?
In the realm of reality.
The Germans are our key ally in the West, but it's interesting to note that the German Communist Party just took control in an election of the German state of Thuringia. Evidently, there is a pro-Russian element within Germany.
In addition, Germany is highly dependent on Russian oil exports. So as those things are connected with each other, I think America can't depend on European support because Europe is so tied to the hip to Russia.
What do you think, Marchand?
One of the things that was very interesting to see was that there were recently anti-war protests taking place in Germany opposing the strangling of Russia. For Americans, World War II it was something that happened over there. We honor our World War II vets, but it was something that happened over there. Germans, one has to remember that people of our grandparents' generation, or if you're older people, your parents' generation, remember the Russian invasion. They remember what happened when the Russians entered East Prussia. They remember what happened when the Russians entered Eastern Germany, when they took Berlin. For Germans, the threat of war with Russia is a very, very real one. And as a result, it's very, very scary. And Germans are really thinking, is this something we really want to be a part of? So I don't know if we can necessarily count on German support in the event of a war, and rationally so, because do they really want to invite the Russians back into Berlin?
Marchand, there is another important conflict in Eastern Europe which bears on the Ukraine situation, which has gotten very little play in the corporate media, and that's the conflict nearby in Transnistria, an enclave in the tiny country of Moldova. Could you talk about where is Transnistria and why is it strategically important?
Transnistria is one of those countries that we say doesn't exist. It's like Abkhazia or South Ossetia. It's technically part of Moldova, but it is an ethnic Russian enclave.
Moldova is between Ukraine and Romania, yeah.
Exactly. And Transnistria is between Moldova and Ukraine. So it's on the western border of Ukraine and northeast of Moldova. And they have their own police. There's a contingent of Russian troops there. They all speak Russian. They have their own government. It is a country that's changed little since the time of the Soviet Union. But it's strategically very important because it really is Russia's foothold still in Eastern Europe and Russia's military foothold in Europe.
And while it's technically still part of Moldova, it is ineffectively seceded and self-governing. And it's got the Russian troops there. And if the Russians could take over Eastern Ukraine, as I understand it, and connect with the ethnic Russians in Transnistria, they would have a much stronger position leverage on the rest of Ukraine, right?
Exactly. One of the things that struck me when I was looking at a map was the pro-Russian forces up until the onset of winter were driving towards Mariupol, which is a strategic Ukrainian port. Well, if they continue that drive southwards, not only would they cut off the Ukrainians from the coast, but additionally, they link up with the pro-Russian, nominally pro-Russian, city of Odessa, which was pro-Russian up until the Ukrainian neo-fascist right sector killed all those ethnic Russians in, I believe it was the town hall, set the building on fire and killed a whole lot of them. But if they were able to link with Odessa, then they could, it'd be a short hop, skip, and jump for their army then to link with Transnistria. And that would create a land bridge between Transnistria and mainland Russia, not only, like I said, cutting Ukraine off from the coast, but directly giving them a land bridge into Europe.
And of course, these places aren't that far afield in the sense that Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union. Moldova was part of the Soviet Union. So these are areas that have a strong connection with the Russians.
Not just that, they're Russian-speaking.
And the people there are Russian-speaking. And to give a little background, when the Soviet Union was dissolved, Transnistria wished to remain within the Soviet Union, while the rest of Moldova, which is predominantly Romanian, the next country over is Romania, wished to be an independent republic. And a militia in Transnistria resisted the new Moldovan government. The new Moldovan government suppressed the Russian ethnics. So that's why the Russian troops intervened, really to protect the Russian ethnics from the Moldovan government. And so, as I understand,
exactly,
there are now about 1,200 Russian troops still there.
These aren't, again, recent events. You know, one of the things that Americans tend to look at Ukraine, and we see it in the light of, okay, you know, the Cold War, the end of the Cold War and whatnot, and this, you know, it was an independent country prior to then. Well, no, Ukraine has always been part of Russia. Breaking Ukraine off from Russia is tantamount to breaking Texas off from the United States. And I say this because Kiev was the first capital of the Rus, the Kingdom of the Rus, which was established around the 12th century. Its first capital was Kiev.
The ties are very strong. And of course, when some of the congressmen and senators discuss the supposed Russian aggression in the Ukraine, they omit the fact that it was the United States-backed coup that removed the elected pro-Russian president of the Ukraine and replaced him with a pro-NATO leader. And that was discussed on cell phone conversations between Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland and the U.S. Ambassador to the Ukraine, in which they were trying to figure out who they would put in as the next leader of the Ukraine.
Well, one thing I also neglect to mention is that the hero of this movement, the hero of Western Ukraine, is a man named Stepan Bandera. He was a Nazi collaborator who was eventually murdered by the KGB in West Germany because he led the Ukrainian independence movement at the end of World War II. But he was a Nazi collaborator. He served in the Nazis' armed forces, along with the other Nazi Ukrainian collaborators. What we've done is not only put in pro-NATO, pro-EU elements, but we put in these neo-Nazi elements. Idolizing Stefan Bandera would be tantamount to idolizing any of the famous French collaborators who collaborated with the Nazis, you know? I mean, it's to say we're backing pro-democracy movements when the Ukrainian militias, using the wolf's angle, which was a Nazi symbol, it was the symbol of the Das Reich Battalion of the SS. A lot of the protesters during the Maidan Rebellion had 8-8 on the back of their helmets, which stands for the eighth letter in the alphabet, which is the letter H, so it's for Heil Hitler. Some of these guys had SS runes on their helmets. So, I mean, it's clear that these guys are not pro-democracy individuals to begin with. One of the reasons why the Russians act with such hostility towards our intervention in Ukraine is that the people we're backing not only are neo-Nazis, but they're also vehemently anti-Russian. And in fact, actually, it's worth mentioning, there was a phone call intercepted from Yulia Tymoshenko, the head of the Fatherland Party, to one of the other cabinet members. It was released on many major news outlets, and she said we have to exterminate the ethnic Russians. We should use nuclear weapons and turn the east of Ukraine, the ethnic Russian regions, into ashes. Yeah. Again, you know, it would be tantamount to, let's say, a Mexican
that's so democratic
saying we should turn all the non-Mexican regions of New Mexico and Texas to ashes. I mean, we'd be outraged by that sentiment, and that's exactly what Yulia Tymoshenko
It seems
said.
Like this situation is not going to go away, and we're going to have to carefully watch how the military ante escalates on either side. Meanwhile, another important story during the past month was the release by the United States Senate of a long-awaited, long-secret investigative report on CIA's torture techniques. Mm-hmm. What is the significance of this report? How do you think it'll affect U.S. foreign relations?
Well, I think the release of the CIA torture report is in much the same vein as the weakening of the military. The fact is that President Obama has had all this time. He's known about the torture. Every president has known that the CIA tortures. It was no secret. It was an open secret, one should say. But the fact is that now he's come out with it at a point in time when he's also fired more generals than any U.S. president in history. And I personally believe that a lot of this is part of his more or less political war between the CIA, the military, and himself. A lot of it is what this does is this weakens the CIA. It damages their legitimacy, it damages their image, and it puts the CIA on the defensive. Because we have to remember that the CIA is loyal to the CIA. It is loyal to its principles, and not necessarily any particular one particular president or another. And certainly the CIA has begun to lock horns in many ways with the Obama administration over its policies in the Middle East, over its policies towards Russia, same as the military has. And wouldn't you know it, suddenly this torture scandal comes out. It's the same thing as General Petraeus hit the scandal coming out suddenly with the affair he was accused of having, whether he actually had it or not is immaterial. The fact is he was accused of it. And, you know, and again, the firing of all these generals, a lot of it points to a rivalry in leadership. And meanwhile, President Obama has no qualms about the NSA spying on American citizens. That, no, he's no problem with that. But waterboarding, that's his main issue. And so clearly he's not acting out of altruistic intentions. I think a lot of it has to do also, you're seeing this the strengthening of the NSA, the DIA, and all these other intelligence agencies, which are, again, much newer than the CIA. But they also, because they're smaller and newer than the CIA, they're not powerful enough to be able to challenge the administration on their own, considering they owe their existence, as it stands right now, to the administration.
Marchand, so, from another point of view, what do you think, do you think that this report will increase the likelihood that American officials might be arrested while traveling abroad and brought to trial?
Absolutely not. I, as far as I'm concerned, I hope the CIA is dissolved, and then if we find a need for a foreign intelligence agency, that it is brought under a close umbrella of authority and leadership from within the government, so that they can actually observe what they're doing. Because right now, no one can see what the CIA does except for the CIA. All this was, it was a audit of documents. And we don't even know how many documents have been destroyed, how many videotapes have been destroyed, how many recordings have been destroyed. They didn't even conduct a single interview to see what the torture was actually like. So as bad as this report was, it didn't even cover a tenth or possibly even a hundredth of what actually took place. Everything that happened that was shown in the report was already known. It showed the number of deaths that occurred under interrogation, and we already knew about most of those. This doesn't consider anything that was done under the leadership of the United States military, nor does it say anything that happened at any of the black sites.
Marchand, during World War II, wasn't it discovered that much better intelligence came from a different approach to interrogation, not using torture?
Well, actually, yes, it was research done on both the part of the Nazis and on the part of the United States. The Nazis had two Luftwaffe interrogation units. One used torture and the other used mental manipulation. And they discovered that mental manipulation was far more successful in getting information out then was tortured. And the same thing was, there was a Major Sherwood Moran of the U.S. Army intelligence who discovered that mental manipulation worked much better. And what I mean by mental manipulation is they discovered that these guys were, they were scared, they were alone. And then you come in as an intelligence officer speaking their native language, and you pretend you already know everything. You know, you say, oh, well, there's nothing you can't tell us that we don't already know. This is just a formality. And, you know, you present them with evidence. Like, one of the things the Luftwaffe would do is they present, they say, we know what squadron you flew with. We know who was in your crew, who was in your squadron. Well, this was stuff they got from their spies back in England. So they already knew all this stuff. But as a result, then it would lull the individual into a false sense of security, thinking, oh, well, there's nothing new I can tell them. And they would end up spilling the beans without actually realizing it. And that was how they gained the most successful amount of information. Because the biggest problem they encountered with torture was that you would say anything to get the torture to stop.
And we've extracted nothing under torture that actually was true or useful. Everything that we have that resulted from these torture sessions, we already knew via other methods.
And isn't there another concern, gentlemen, that if we torture prisoners, that our adversaries may feel that they're entitled to do the same to an American prisoner?
There's a very good quote by Omar Mukhtar. Now, I don't know if he actually said it or not, but it was in the film Lion of the Desert, which is a fantastic movie. Omar Mukhtar was the Libyan freedom fighter who fought against the Italian fascists. But when asked, when told, hey, we're going to shoot these Italian prisoners, Omar said, no, they are our enemies, not our teachers. And I think that's one thing that we certainly need to rise above, is being like our enemies.
But yeah, who's the good guy here?
The main point that at least I glean from these torture files is that there's a rivalry inside the agencies. Mm-hmm. And certainly one of the things that struck me is I'm reading a phenomenal biography right now about Stalin. And one of the things he did is when Lenin took power, there was one intelligence organ, one domestic secret police, and it was the Cheka. And they handled all of the foreign intelligence, they handled the suppression of the czarists and all that stuff. Well, when Stalin came to power, one of the things he did is he created plethora of other intelligence organizations, the NKVD, the NKGB, the MGB, the GRU. I mean, there are more than I can name. But one of the reasons why I created all these different organizations was that so no one would be powerful enough to oppose him. Now, we contrast it today. What's President Obama doing? He's firing all his generals. He's discrediting the one intelligence agency that is probably the most powerful intelligence agency and handing it off to this plethora of other agencies, which by themselves are not powerful enough to challenge him. And I think that's really what this is about. It isn't that President Obama suddenly discovered he has a conscience, but rather I think a lot more has to do with the fact that he feels the CIA is in a position to challenge him.
There have been two Justice Department investigations of the torture under President Obama, and neither of them resulted in anybody being indicted. If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Streaming at WPKN.org, I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host. I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator, and Gus Canavero, our producer. We've been talking about the fallout from the United States Senate's release of the long-suppressed report on CIA's torture. Now, Marshawn, in a dramatic offensive earlier this year, forces of the Islamic State captured Mosul, the second largest city in Iraq. The Iraqi government reportedly plans to attempt to retake Mosul and a ground attack this winter. Meanwhile, the U.S. military has launched hundreds of air attacks around Mosul to disrupt the Islamic State's supply lines. Marshawn, do you think the Iraqi army is up to fighting a messy urban war to retake Mosul?
At this stage, not yet. I mean, right now they're holding their own, but they've launched several offensives. And so far, I mean, they're still losing ground. In Anbar province, apparently they're holding on by their fingernails. Anbar province is in the west of Iraq, but most importantly, it is right on the edge of Baghdad. If ISIS takes all of Anbar province, Baghdad will be virtually surrounded. So, I mean, at this stage, I think they're just trying desperately to hold on. I think a lot of these offensives are for domestic consumption to show we're still fighting. But again, we have to look at Iraqi military history. If you look back at the Iran-Iraq war, the Iraqis launched a lot of very pointless offensives in order to try to make it look like they were winning.
So where is the Islamic State getting its support?
A lot of it right now comes through Syria. Certainly a lot of the organizations we've been funneling money to have been funneling that money directly to ISIS. And then ISIS has been receiving a lot of support from the Gulf states, and it's possible they're also receiving it from Saudi Arabia as well.
Now, I'm wondering, too, if some of the elements within Iraq that don't like the United States are also supporting the Islamic State, in particular Baathists.
That's very possible. I mean, we have discovered that a lot of Baathists who held government positions prior to the U.S. invasion have now been given government posts in places like Mosul and Raqqa and whatnot. And that's one of the reasons why ISIS is the most dangerous terrorist organization on the planet, because unlike the Taliban, who just showed in, took over, and enforced their own strict Sharia law, these guys come in, take over, enforce their own strict Sharia law, and they can administer. They keep, you know, as best they can, to keep the lights on, try to keep the TVs on. This basically has allowed them to not necessarily win support amongst the local populace, but get the populace to believe, well, if I just keep my head down, I'll be okay.
What's the extent of the U.S. involvement apart from air support?
Well, actually, the biggest revelation was December 17th. According to reports by the Fiscal Times and the Kurdish press, an Iraqi field commander stated that U.S. forces were now involved in ground combat in Anbar province, trying to help hold on to it so Baghdad doesn't get encircled. I mean, this is huge, because even if these guys are just special forces, which we know have been on the ground for a long time, it means that for the first time, U.S. troops are directly engaged in ground combat with the Iraqi army against ISIS. So it's a huge step in terms of mission creep. I mean, if we compare it to like Vietnam, it started out with a handful of advisors, and now it's starting to turn into more and more, more ground commitment. And it might be part of President Obama's idea of, well, if I just kind of creep it in, people won't notice, sort of a thing.
And now we have, I understand, 3,100 troops in Iraq, and supposedly our allies are going to send another 1,500, but still doesn't seem like a very significant force.
No, I mean, realistically, what we should have done in the beginning, and hindsight is always 20/20, but I think a blind person could have seen this in the beginning, when ISIS came in with, you know, pickup trucks, if we had hit them from the air and brought in a few special forces, they would have dissipated. And then if we stopped giving money to Syrian rebels, this certainly would have dissipated. But one of the biggest problems was that we recognized it far too late, or either that or we recognized it but refused to commit far too late. And then the other problem is that we haven't stopped giving ISIS money via these quote-unquote Syrian Free Army elements, many of which have defected or sworn their allegiance to ISIS. Another thing that's also interesting to note was that ISIS has now gotten the Ansar Beit al-Maqdis in the Sinai, which is an Egyptian Islamist organization, to swear their allegiance. And certainly the moment that happened, we noticed the combat effectiveness of Ansar Beit al-Maqdis skyrocketed in terms of their ability to inflict heavy casualties on the Egyptian army.
So there's somebody with a deep pocket is supporting the Islamic State.
Absolutely. And like I say, I think it's a combination of, on the one hand, the Gulf states, who are immensely wealthy and despise the Shia and have a history of supporting Islamist movements like the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Certainly Saudi Arabia is definitely up there on the list. And then, of course, Turkey seems to have, at the very least, turned a blind eye, if not gotten involved with ISIS. They allowed ISIS fighters to enter through Turkey to attack a Kurdish border crossing with Turkey.
And they hate the Kurds more than they hate ISIS, so ISIS is just doing their dirty work for them.
Exactly. It's not because they love Islamists, but it's because they hate the Kurds that
much.
And then I think the third factor in who's supporting them, where they're getting their money from, is the United States, because we've been doling money out pretty much, in my opinion, blindly to anybody we think is moderate Syrians. And certainly many of these moderate Syrians have turned around and sworn allegiance to ISIS.
And we've been handicapping all the people who are most powerful to be able to stop them, like the Syrian government, and keeping Iran out of the fight.
Now, Marshawn, op-ed in the Army Times recently, you proposed that the United States cooperate with Iran as well as Russia in fighting the Islamic State on the grounds that these states share our antipathy towards radical Islamists. And I understand that Iran is now involved in the air war in Iraq. Can you talk about Iran's contribution and whether it could be decisive?
Absolutely. Well, I certainly think that somebody at the Pentagon stole my idea, but that's a different story. It's in the Army Times, and all of a sudden, Iran's bombing ISIS. But I think one of the things that struck me was that When Iran started bombing ISIS, the John Kirby, the Pentagon spokesman, said, well, that's up to the Iraqis whether they want to coordinate with the Iranians. We're not coordinating with them, but it's up to the Iraqis. It's because one of the things that we're gradually starting to realize is we can do business with Iran. We can do business with Syria. I mean, let's face it. At the end of the day, people rather have flat screen TVs and SUVs than, you know, nuclear weapons. You can do business with the government. ISIS's stated goal is to attack the United States. I mean, ISIS is an even greater threat to our security than Russia is. I mean, as you can see from ISIS-inspired attacks in places like Canada and most recently in Australia, ISIS is certainly a far greater threat. By cooperating with the Syrians, with the Iranians, we can eliminate this common enemy. We have allied ourselves with some pretty horrible people in the past because of a common enemy. If we look at World War II, Stalin, who killed more people than Hitler did, was our ally because we felt Hitler was the greatest threat. If we had been truly as we will only be friends with fellow democratic societies, we would have fought the Soviets as well as the Nazis. Realpolitik, we have to ally ourselves with allies of convenience. And certainly our allies of convenience at this stage would be Iran and Syria.
Marshawn, Secretary of State John Kerry is going to ask the new Congress for a new authorization for the use of military forces for the global war against the Islamic State. That would include authority for U.S. ground troops. This new law would be modeled on the 2001 authorization for the use of military force. That was the basis for the Afghan war and the war on terror. What is the significance, do you think, of Secretary Kerry's intention?
Well, the authorization for the use of military force was most recently used to authorize the invasion of Iraq. And the thing is, it gives the administration open mandate to fight ISIS in whatever capacity he deems necessary, or, you know, the leaders in the U.S. deem necessary. After January, they decide they want to send, you know, 100,000 U.S. ground troops. The authorization for the use of military force would enable them to do that. Now, just passing the bill is no guarantee that we're going to deploy 100,000 troops, but it gives them that ability. The administration has stated it doesn't want to deploy ground troops, but clearly from its actions, we see that it's willing to, it has, and this authorization will give them a mandate to deploy ground troops in combat.
Man, what is wrong with Congress that they just can't get the guts to declare war or not declare war? Why do they always have to pass the authority onto the president?
These politicians have more or less become careerists. You know, for them, Congress is not about representing the American people. It's a career path, and it's about preserving their career path. Today, they don't want to be the bad guys because goodness knows that could cost them the next election.
Or one of them might be president, and they might want to use that power.
Exactly. That's the other thing, too, is any member of Congress might want to one day run for president, and they don't want to necessarily shoot themselves in the foot. It's the same reason why they haven't challenged the president in a substantive way on his executive actions. I mean, his executive orders have been to topple the Libyan government, to bomb Libya, put American troops in harm's way, to kill the Libyan president, to bomb Syria, and put sanctions and constraints on Russia.
Yes, and as we've often pointed out, there really is no debate in this country over foreign policy, and that there is no anti-interventionist perspective that's ever given any kind of prominence in the discussion. It's expressed by people like Denis Kucinich or Ralph Nader or Ron Paul, but it never gets even the dignity of being on the platform. Yeah. The Republican Party is in a state of amnesia. One of the most prominent anti-interventionists in our history was Senator Robert Taft of Ohio, who was known as Mr. Republican in the 1950s. It's only really in the modern era that there seems to be this bipartisan consensus for intervention. If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott-Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott-Rowe, our military affairs commentator, and Gus Canavero, our producer. This show is broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month from noon to 1 p.m., and the show will be archived at our website, incontextreport.com, and you can sign up for our podcast via Radio for All and iTunes. Contact us at ken@mdrtalk.org. That's ken@mdrtalk.org. Marshawn, we're talking about the possibility of U.S. ground troops being authorized for global war against the Islamic State, but the U.S. military keeps getting cut back. Our army, a standing army, is around 500,000 troops. I think our listeners might be interested in the evolution of the U.S. military tradition versus, say, the European tradition, which includes Russia, and how it connects to this idea of a relatively small army. Could you talk about, let's say, the 18th century origins of the American army and how it contrasts with the way things developed in Europe later on?
One of the key factors in the development of the U.S. military was an inherent fear of the military. When we look at the military in Great Britain, in Europe at the, in general at the time, but particularly in Great Britain, which was the father of the United States, there was a strong fear of a large standing army. And a lot of this held over from the times of Oliver Cromwell, the times of the Stuarts, when the army was used against the people. So we look at Britain at the time, the army was kept relatively small and mainly designed for wars either on the continent, small wars on the continent, or colonial wars. So most of the army was overseas. The territorial army, which was more or less like a militia, did most of the home defense. That was really something that was imparted to our founding fathers, the same sort of fear that a large standing army will be used against the American people and be used by a leader to become a king or become a dictator.
Right, because most military leaders in history have gone on to have a coup and become the king, you know, a la Napoleon and how many others.
Well, it was actually the Napoleonic War that changed the European mentality, because after the Battle of Valmy, the British suddenly realized and the other European countries started to realize that having a small professional army was no longer capable of fighting this mass army of the people that Napoleon had. And one of the most defining factors was the defeat of Prussia. After the Battle of Jena, Prussia was forced to sign a humiliating alliance with Napoleon. And what developed out of that afterwards was a coalition of reforming officers, men like Geisenau, Scharnhorst, and Karl von Clausewitz, the famous author of On War, was that the army needed to be representative of the people, not led by a clique of aristocrats, not made up of a handful of professional soldiers, but representative of the nation, because they believed that the state exists because of the army. The army doesn't exist because of the state. The state exists because of the army. And a similar mentality came over in Britain that really we need a large army of the people, because Napoleon was sweeping across the continent, and it was pretty clear to most Brits that Napoleon was a hop, skip, and a jump from invading England. What developed out of this, instead of a fear of the army, was the idea that the army is the people, because the army now was made up of ordinary citizens going to fight against Napoleon. And in the case of Prussia, they developed what was called the Lützow Battalion, which was an all-volunteer battalion made up of ordinary farmers, basically, ordinary men. The officers were professional officers, but they were no longer just aristocrats. What's interesting, the colors for the modern German flag, the orange, red, and black, comes from the colors of the Lützow Battalion. So this whole idea that the army is a tool to suppress the people really dissipated in the time of Napoleon. And this is when we see that very large professional army, but the army as a representative of the people rather than as a representative of the king.
Ironically, in the United States, while we have a small standing army, the threat to personal liberty seems to be coming from the development of this very large civilian national security apparatus, starting with the CIA at the end of just after World War II.
Our founding fathers never had this experience, because we had the War of 1812, but it didn't have quite the same impact on us as the Napoleonic Wars did on Europe. One of the things we were kind of left out of is the idea that the army is the people, not, you know, a means to suppress the people. And certainly one thing we see is that Stalin, in the Soviet Union, he didn't use the Red Army to suppress the masses. He used the NKVD, he used the secret police, which he made more powerful, stronger, better equipped than the army was. And the army was controlled by the NKVD. The generals were not independent. And one of the things we see too, as well in Nazi Germany, was that the army was no longer, that was not the tool to suppress the masses, but the Gestapo, the SS, they were the tool, and they were the elite government loyalists. This fear that a large standing army is dangerous, I fear a large security apparatus far more than I do a large standing army, because a large standing army, ordinary soldiers, men and women from your cities and towns, are not going to go in the middle of the night and, you know, take your weapons and arrest you, and, you know, because they're just like you. But government fanatics, that's where the true danger to civil liberties lie. And I think because we lacked that experience of the Napoleonic Wars, in many ways, we overlook the security apparatus, and we still tend to focus far more on the military.
We were talking about the average American soldier, and that brings to mind an important event that took place during World War I. I'd like to mention it because this show will be broadcast just before Christmas. And that event was the famous Christmas Truce that took place on a World War I battlefield in France in 1914. Marshawn, could you talk about this Christmas Truce?
Well, the Christmas Truce was one of the most bizarre events in military history, because all along the front at this point, 1914, had pretty much stabilized into static lines of defense. I mean, lines of trenches facing opposing each other. And the Germans and the French and the Brits would periodically launch pointless, catastrophic offensives against each other and wipe each other out. But during the Christmas Truce, at certain points along the front, and actually the most famous event on the front was German soldiers were singing Silent Night, Stille Nacht in German. The British soldiers recognized this, so they started singing along in English. And they sang Christmas songs together from opposite sides of the trench. Well, then one German soldier climbs up out of his trench and just starts walking towards the British lines. So the British officer is, the sentries and the British officers bewildered. And then the British soldiers start climbing out of their trench to greet this German. And then the German soldiers started climbing out of their trench, and they met in the middle of no man's land. And it's one of the most powerful events, but also one of the most bizarre events in military history, because traditionally soldiers from both sides would run into each other and, you know, they would, you know, exchange something and, you know, maybe talk and then walk away, you know. But this was, in many points along the front, soldiers just climbed out of their trench and started talking.
So it was spontaneous.
Exchange.
Exactly. It wasn't arranged by the generals. It just happened.
No, not at all. Much to the annoyance of most of the officers, because they thought it was a trick. But they actually at one point in the trench, they started playing football. Soccer, as Americans call it, but football. They started playing football. And ironically, during one of these matches, the Germans won. And one of the British soldiers famously said, oh, this doesn't bode well for us. One of the fascinating things is that people who knew each other prior to the war ran into each other. One man ran into a German who had been his barber in London and was now in the German army. Immediately, I mean, the effect was incredible. You know, these guys who had been killing each other just a day before were now suddenly, you know, shaking hands and exchanging photographs and pieces of gear and whatnot. You know, British soldiers famously asked for the German spiked helmet, the Pickelhaber helmet. It was, again, one of the most incredible events in military history. And they returned to their trenches afterwards. And a famous order came out from the British High Command saying that fraternization with the enemy is basically treason and you'll be executed. At other points in the front line, people tried to do this and they ended up getting shot by the other side by accident. But, I mean, the fact is, along large portions of the trench, British and German, French and German soldiers met and they had basically this informal truce. It's one of the most incredible events. I encourage any of our listeners, especially this time of year, to go. And there was a great History Channel documentary called The Christmas Truce. You can find it on YouTube now.
There's actually a phenomenal Christmas ad that a British department store released that was basically a high quality, high production value cinematic portrayal of the Christmas Truce. And it was a really great commercial because it was not about selling product. In fact, the only product that was exchanged between the two soldiers was a bar of chocolate that didn't even have a brand name on it. So they really were not about selling a product. And that's why I really love this commercial. You can find it on YouTube. Just search Christmas Truce, Christmas commercial.
While soldiers are divided by nation and by politics, fundamentally, soldiers are all the same.
We're all people. Yeah, well, doesn't the Christmas Truce go to show that people all over the world really are the same and they don't want to fight when it comes down to it? Because if the soldiers around the world laid down arms, right, and they just said, look, we're not going to fight because the government tells us to, who else is going to do it? Are the politicians going to go out there because they hate each other so much and stick each other bayonets? I don't think so.
I don't think so. I don't think the politicians
war would stop if people stopped fighting.
The
right?
Top businessmen who see advantage in war are going to go down in the trench.
Interest.
That's what this show is about, largely, is to show the real causes of war and so that people understand why that the real causes of war, rather than the phony ones that were fed through the propaganda machine from the government and from the networks, then they'll understand, they'll think more critically, and they'll think of ways of advancing this country's interests without warfare.
Mm-hmm.
what we need to do, we need to have a strong military, we need to have a large military, but at the same time, we need to assure our veterans and our soldiers that we will not send you to war unless it's absolutely necessary.
Marshawn, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, but thank you very much for your thoughts on that. And we'd like to wish a Merry Christmas to all of you, especially to our soldiers serving back here at home or abroad. And we wish them all a safe and a peaceful new year. And that's it for this edition of the In Context War Report. The In Context War Report is produced by MDR Productions, Inc. and is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. This program will be archived at WPKN.org, at RadioForAll.org, and on our show's website, IncontextReport.com. And you can sign up for podcasts of the series via iTunes and Radio for All. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at Ken@MDRTalk.org. On behalf of In Context Military Affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott Rowe, producer Gus Canavero, this is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and a Merry Christmas.
See ya. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.